Hello, everyone. Welcome. Welcome to the first conference by Rethinking Economics Norway. My name's Ingrid. I'm a PhD student in economics at the New School, and I'm on the board of the Rethinking Economics Norway, and I'll be chairing this session here. So this is the launch of this book, Alternative Theories of Economic Development, edited by Erik Reinert, Jayati Ghosh, and Rainer Kattell. This is day one out of a two-day conference by Rethinking Economics. Tomorrow we'll be at the University of Oslo, and we have a full-day program, 9:30 to 6, and there are some spots left, so if you want to secure your spot, you should register if you haven't already. There we have lots of debates about financial crisis, the climate crisis, Keynes, Marx, Hayek, lots of different economic perspectives. With great speakers. You see some of the names there. We also have one of our English colleagues coming, Joe Earle, who is also the author of the book Econocracy, The Peril of Leaving Economics to the Experts. So he'll be there tomorrow. Rethinking Economics, if you don't already know, is a student movement. It started in the UK after the financial crisis. A lot of undergraduate students, actually, started noticing that they, with the tools that they were learning in their, at the university in their economics classes, they couldn't explain what they were actually observing. They couldn't explain the financial crisis. So there was a revolt, basically. So the aim of this movement is to improve the education, to learn more theories, to broaden economists' understanding of what's going on around us. And it's grown a lot since 2008. There's now more than 100 student associations around the world, in 30 countries, I think. And Rethinking Economics Norway just started last summer. And we've also grown a lot. We have 5 local chapters, I think, now, around the country. And this is our first conference, and we already have a lot of attendees. The conference tomorrow, we had to switch to a larger room to accommodate this huge demand for alternative thinking on economics. So that's great. And our goal as Rethinking Economics Norway is to enrich and renew the way we think about the field of economics. We want to do this by drawing on theories and perspectives and frameworks within the economics discipline that's been marginalized in the mainstream economics education since the 70s. So a part of this goal is presenting alternative theories. So this book launch is a part of this effort. This book is incredible in scope and in depth. It presents theories from many different regions of the world and from many different perspectives that you won't find in the mainstream economic development courses, at most universities at least. I won't talk too much about this book because we have the editors here, all 3 of them. So I'll give the microphone to them in a second. I just want to introduce them briefly. So we have Jayati Ghosh here, who's a professor of economics at Jawaharlal Nehru University, JNU, in New Delhi, India. And she's one of the leading development economists in the world, a regular contributor to The Guardian in the UK, as well as many Indian newspapers. She's Executive Secretary of International Development Economics Associates, IDEAS, which is an international network on heterodox economics. For those of you who don't know the lingo, heterodox is the word for not mainstream, basically. Her current research is on globalization, international trade, employment patterns in developing countries, macroeconomic policy issues related to gender and development, and the implications of recent growth in China and India. And in 2011, she was awarded the ILO Decent Work Research Prize for distinguished scholars. We also have Erik Reinert here with us, who's a professor of technology, governance, and development strategies at Tallinn University in Estonia. He's the founder of the Other Canon Foundation, which is a center and network for heterodox economics research, so non-mainstream research. His research interests and publications are focused on theories of uneven development, history of economic thought and policy, the role of the state in economic development, and his well-known book, How Rich Countries Got Rich and Why Poor Countries Stay Poor, won the Myrdal Prize in Economics and the Norwegian Selvåg Prize as well in 2008. And last but not least, we have Rainer Kattell, the third editor of the volume. who's the professor and chair of innovation policy and technology governance at the Tallinn University in Estonia. He's a member of the evaluation board of Estonian Research Council, belongs to the European Commission's expert group on public sector innovation. His main research area is industrial and innovation policies in catching up economies, especially Central and Eastern Europe and Latin America. He has published extensively on innovation policy and development economics, and in 2012, he was awarded the Estonian National Science Prize in Social Sciences. So we have three prize winners here with us. Jaya Tigas, I welcome you.
Well, thank you so much for inviting us. I'm absolutely delighted to be here. And I'm particularly delighted that this is an initiative of young people because, you know, we've left you a very bad place. But when I see all of you, I think maybe you can make it better. So it gives me confidence to know that there are young people like you around. And I'm also delighted that it's about rethinking economics because, in a way, that's also what this book is trying to do. And it's people keep asking us about the motivation, and I'll come back to that in a minute. But in a way, the motivation was to actually rescue both economics and development economics from what they have become, to sort of pull them back from the abyss where of complete irrelevance into something that we can actually use to understand our societies and economies and the way the world is generally. But maybe I should just begin by giving you a little bit of a flavor of what it is. It's a very big, fat book. It's the kind of book that gives you a hernia if you have to carry it too long. This is the cover of the book, 850 pages, I think. But we are trying to do it. The reason it's so big and fat is because we're trying to do it to approach the subject from very different complementary perspectives, historically, that is to say, looking at the theories over history, the mercantilist, the cameralist theories of the Renaissance that were further developed from the Enlightenment, geographically, including development thinking in China, in India, in Africa, in Muslim approaches, the Ottoman approach, all kinds of things like that, Latin American schools, different schools, not just the 19th century standard kinds of things, or but how development theory was seen in the United States, Marxist, Schumpeterian, Latin American structuralism, the Régulation school in France, those different approaches. Institutions, how did institutions shape how development occurred? The League of Nations, the Havana Charter, UNCTAD, and topics that now seem contemporary, but actually obviously have shaped development all the way through. The role of finance, feminism, the agrarian issue, ecology and the environment, and things like that. Just to give you a sense, because I think otherwise it's really hard to see the extent of it, we have 40 chapters and an introduction and 50 authors. And I'm delighted that two of the authors are here. Lars Mjoset and Sylvie Andresen are with us, and that's wonderful for us as well. So beginning with development thinking across history and geography, we have a chapter on Giovanni Botero and Antonio Serra that Eric has contributed in terms of really how a lot of the classic things that people think of as emerging much, much later were already evident way back, whether in terms of economies of scale and the advantages of division of labor or all kinds of things. There's a chapter on economic emulation and how the politics of international trade in early modern Europe affected the possibilities of emulation. There's a chapter on cameralism and the German tradition of development economics. Friedrich Liszt is a very important figure in the early part of this book. And there is, of course, a chapter on him, and specifically on his work, from spiritual and competitive power to collaboration. But in a sense, the spirit of Liszt imbues a lot of the other chapters because he influenced so much of the development thought, not just in Europe, but elsewhere, in terms of actually what was practiced, not necessarily what was propounded. There's a chapter on the German historical school. There are two chapters on Chinese development thinking, which is actually fascinating. And it's very understudied or little recognized in terms of the insights that it can provide. in Imperial China and subsequently. There's a chapter on the Islamic world and capitalism, how it viewed it, what the nature of that interaction was, what the theories that emerged were. A chapter on Ottoman national economy thinking, and where, in fact, the significance of Liszt's approach become very clear in how they influenced Ottoman approaches to development. There's a chapter on development thinking in India, which does a long historical spread, but some of it is remarkably contemporary. We had a 5th century economist, if you like, called Kautilya. He wrote a book called Arthashastra, which quite literally means economics, which was more really a treatise on statecraft. It was sort of an early version of Machiavelli and less cynical. But in there, you get ideas about basic income. You get ideas of, you know, the issues related to income distribution and how a king has to actually deal with those. So lots of very contemporary issues that were actually talked about even then. And of course, this chapter then traces the evolution of Indian thinking over the centuries. Latin American structuralism, the debate, two chapters on Africa, one on the whole notion of autonomous, national autonomous development, another on development as a struggle for liberation from hegemonic structures of domination and control globally and, of course, locally. Then the institutions, there is a chapter on the League of Nations and alternative economic perspectives, the Havana Charter, which really, in a sense, was a kind of mother load for a lot of 20th century development orientation. The UNCTAD system of political economy, those of you who don't know, UNCTAD was created by developing countries who felt that the global international order was not working in their favor, and they really had to actually project a different view of both the international economy and the process of development that would more accurately reflect their concerns. A chapter on Marxist theory, which talks also about the nature of underdevelopment as a process, economic development as an evolutionary process by the kind of grandfather of these theories, Richard Nelson. Then a chapter on the classical development economists of the mid-20th century, including people like Nerxe and Myrdal and others who came also from this region. Regulation theory, in France and elsewhere in Europe that emerged, a chapter on the dependency school, a chapter on feminist approaches to development. It's important because, and I'll come back to why it's important, because it's typically underplayed. And the significance of looking at things through a gender lens, having a gender perspective in terms of how it affects your understanding of the economy, something that people don't think about. They think of women being acted upon by development rather than gender relations structuring how development occurs. But I'll come back to that. Freeman, we have some chapters on individual thinkers who have provided quite extraordinary insights. There's a chapter on Freeman and the work on technology. There's a chapter on Hirschman and a chapter on Michal Kaleski, the Polish economist who is often thought of only really as, you know, the sort of East European Keynes, but had many, many more insights into development processes. And then we have some discussion of the issues in development, the agrarian question and how it's related to economic transformation, the effective demand approach to development. Jan Kregel has written something on development planning, the Nordic route to development by Lars Mjøset, who is here with us. Competitiveness and development, basically taking a Schumpeterian approach to the whole discussion of what competitiveness is. Discussion of innovation systems and development, latecomer industrialization, the developmental state in the 20th century, the relationship of development with ecology and the environment, competition policy, governing knowledge, intellectual property management, legal structures and development, then deindustrialization. There's a very interesting paper on post-industrial extinctions and how that is related to the rise of jihadi terrorism, which perhaps we can discuss if people are interested later. And a fascinating epilogue, which Sylvie Andresen also contributed to, basically on the possibilities of, if you like, the opposite of development, by which I don't mean necessarily underdevelopment, but things like technological retrogression, that that processes of change need not always be linear and moving forward, but can go in all kinds of complicated ways. So as you can see, that's why it's 850 pages. That's why it is so enormous. So very quickly, what were we trying to do? Why? Why do all this huge, big breadth and, you know, get lots of different people and make this hernia-creating volume? Essentially, I think there were three broad motivations. One, as I said in the very beginning, is to rescue both economics and development economics from the terrible state into which they have fallen. And what do I mean by that? I mean that economics has, and development economics both, actually, in a way, became the preserve of, well, people like to think of it as dead white men, but even living white men, typically North Atlantic white men. I know we're in the North Atlantic right now, but it doesn't include Norway. It's a North Atlantic without Norway. It's an Anglo-Saxon hegemony of both the discipline and, you know, if you like, the policy conclusions that emerge from that discipline. But in fact, it's not just that they are northern white men, but also that even the northern white men who are saying sensible things are excluded. Some of the ones sitting here, for example. In other words, anyone who doesn't fit a particular paradigm is largely lost in the discussion, and we wanted to bring back all those insights. There is so much knowledge that we lose out on because all our knowledge has been filtered and processed like processed cheese and brought back to us in a very, very rigid and often irrelevant format. And I think Eric will have a lot more to say about this tension between relevance and, if you like, abstraction. And for abstraction here, read mathematics. So we wanted to bring back the fact that there's a very, very rich tradition of development thinking, that in fact economists have always looked at development. The idea that there is a thing called development economics and then there's a thing called real economics is completely false. The economists who matter and who actually have added to knowledge over time, over the centuries, looked at all economies as they were developing. Their concerns were growth, distribution, accumulation, how it all played out, processes of structural change. These were their concerns. And so, in a sense, it's not true that, you know, there's a separate thing called development. It's all economies are developing, including Norway. They're changing in different ways. They're undergoing structural change. They're undergoing processes. And to have that historical dynamic perspective actually transforms the way in which you look at the object of study, in a way. This is particularly evident in development economics because, you see, the other thing we wanted to rescue development economics from is this rather obsessive focus on the micro. Compared to even, you know, the mid to, you know, until even the 1960s, when development, the processes of development were recognized to be, you know, much broader and systemic and structural, the last 30 or 40 years has seen a reversion into a very micro focus on development. And it's really now all about poverty alleviation, or to quote the SDGs, poverty eradication. And that is supposed to happen by changing the attributes of the poor, because the poor are poor because of their attributes. They're not poor because there are other rich people out there. They're not poor because there's a systemic process that is generating poverty. They're poor because they don't have education, or they're doing the wrong things, they're making the wrong choices, you know, all of those usual things. And then there are all these micro-theoretic approaches, which then become policy approaches on how to address that. So let's give them nutrition supplements. Then, you know, it doesn't matter if they don't really get enough food to eat. Let's give them X. Let's give them Y. Let's give them a conditional cash transfer because they're too dumb to know that they have to send their children to school otherwise. It's that kind of micro approach, both in theory and in policy, which development got reduced to, that we want to break away from and bring back the role of systemic and policy and so on. In particular, well, I suppose the apotheosis of that today would be the RCT, the randomized control trial. I don't know how many of you have heard of this. It comes from epidemiology, you know, where you do little experiments on people. And you say, oh, guess what? If we put toilets in the school, more girls come. You know, that kind of thing. And then you say, it's a good idea, therefore, to put toilets in the schools. A lot of research is going on now. It's become the latest, toy of the sort of development economics across the world, the mainstream development economics. Okay, so that was, as I said, the second motivation. The third motivation, in a way, was therefore to also rescue development economics from this whole, and development policy, if I might add, from the obsession with fads. The development industry is massively characterized by fads. I'm old enough now to have lived through many of them. But I remember when the time was that, you know, you had to get rid of state control. And once you liberalized markets, things would work. And the problem with so many developing countries is that they were too statist and government intervention. That didn't work. So then they said, okay, the real thing we need is microcredit. Let's give them lots of microfinance, and then everything will be, you know, the silver bullet for poverty reduction. That didn't work either. So then they said, okay, the thing to do is conditional cash transfers. You know, we give them cash, and then, of course, they don't know what to do with it. So we have to tell them how to use it and how to be good and behave well in order to get the cash. And that will then do something. Turns out that's not working either. So now the new thing is actually to use RCTs to think of micro interventions that might work. None of this has anything to do with development. In fact, all of these micro attempts to actually transform or reduce poverty, et cetera, are doomed to fail because they don't recognize that, you know, material progress is actually something that is systemic and structural and requires productive transformation of the economies and requires particular patterns of employment generation and so on. So we wanted to bring out how this has occurred over different countries, continents, or how it has not occurred in other countries and continents. And I think finally, in a sense, what we wanted to do was to bring out that you cannot do economics, including development economics, without actually looking at a whole lot of other stuff, without understanding the society, the culture, the history, the politics, the geopolitical context. And that a lot of the articles are incredibly rich in that respect, in terms of linking all of this with economic processes. It's not just that, you know, you should do it in general to be a good social scientist. It is that you really don't understand those economic processes until you look at the interaction with the culture and with the society and how it all plays out. The chapter on feminist approaches, for example, highlights the critical role played by unpaid labor in, you know, enabling accumulation and development across very, very critical phases of industrialization, of course, in Northern Europe, but and across a range of countries, including East and Southeast Asia, the more recent successes. You don't understand that unless you understand how gender is constructed in society and how women's labor, unpaid labor, is, you know, neither recognized nor rewarded, but certainly taken for granted and used, and how the fact that the women supply the unpaid labor in turn determines the nature of their entry into workforces. The fact that the work they do then also is underpaid, because anyway they're doing unpaid work, so, you know, if you get a little bit, then that's much better. And the kinds of work they do, and how this in turn operates as a subsidy to the accumulation process. So people often think of how development affects women, but they don't think of how the fact of having different social constructions of men and women change how development works. And I think that's a very important insight that we miss otherwise. Similarly, in terms of, you know, the jihadi, and, you know, there is a fascinating article which is showing how the post-industrial extinction, basically the complete and dramatic deindustrialization of these countries in Central Asia, actually led to a peculiar reversion to feudalism. And it became a feudalism based on patron-client relationships, which in turn were, of course, unequal, which meant that, you know, the people at the bottom of that ladder, it wasn't just that they lost their jobs. They were then dependent on a feudal patronage system that actually also denied them respect and agency at the same time as they witnessed that growing inequality, where some were getting all the spoils of the new system. And so you get a combination of frustration and a need to find other, ways of expressing their anger, which are in turn operating through semi-feudal kinds of processes like gangs, which end up becoming sources of jihadi terrorism and so on. So in other words, basically what the book is trying to show is that there's a lot that we don't really have to relearn, that is already there in terms of knowledge. And we ignore all of that, not just at our peril, but we ignore all of that at great loss to just the satisfaction that can come from understanding particular realities. I think it's also true that this is an incredibly good time for a book like this to come out. Eric is going to explain exactly why. But I think it's a good time because it's very clear that there's a lot of confusion about what's going on in the world. There's a lot of searching for theoretical frameworks that will help us to understand it. And I hope that some of the articles in this book will actually help us to move in that direction. Thank you.